Thank you very much. I very much appreciate the Extreme History Program, Crystal, for allowing me to get the information out to you about what I do as far as research. And I got to tell you, it's kind of interesting. I don't have a research appointment. I do this because I love doing the research. So this is all kind of over and above what my normal position is. I also have to tell you that I'm not a historian. I am actually more of a scientist. Actually, I'm not even really a scientist. I'm more of an extension communicator. My wife is getting her PhD in history, so I leave the history to her. But we'll talk a little bit about history today, a little about science, and a little bit about the really cool project that I've been working on. So that is the Montana Heritage Orchard Program. So I met this gentleman, Brent Sarche. He's the Lewis and Clark County Extension agent in Helena, Montana. And he came to me one day and said, I want to do fruit tree research. And I, being the specialist, I helped the agents. And I said, sure, let's do some projects. So I worked with him now for over 5 years. We have planted orchards. This is not the historic Heritage Orchard Program, but this is in fact an orchard that we planted, one of 10 that has identical apples, pears, and plums in the same orchard, 10 times replicated from Columbia Falls to Colstrip. So we're trying to get out in Montana and try to get people to grow fruit again, because we haven't done really a lot of fruit research in Montana at Montana State University since the 1970s. And so we have a really kind of rich growing environment. Here is Brent putting in a tree. He is one of the most energetic people I've ever met. Here he is with some bare root stock putting some trees in. And that's actually me in the background doing some mulching or something. But we do a lot of tree fruit research. And he came to me and he says, man, there are some old orchards around the state, and I would love to know what some of those different varieties are. And this is really nothing new. This is something that other researchers at Montana State University has tried to do. In fact, I was just talking to an orchard owner today that was in the Livingston area and talked about how Orville McCarver used to come to his house and try to figure out what these different apples were. That kind of gave us the idea of doing this Heritage Orchard Program. But since we're talking about history, I want to go back in time a little bit here. If you can imagine and think about the people that were coming from St. Louis or Chicago and getting in these wagons with everything that they owned and coming out west to hit parts of Montana and 160 acres to try to make a living. I always want to know, what's in that wagon? What were the important things that they brought with them? And in fact, there were lists, there were ideas. You had to have a certain amount of sugar, certain amount of salt, all of these different things so that you could survive for that first amount of time. And what's really interesting that a lot of people don't talk about is that they would put scion wood, or they would put saplings of trees inside their coats to keep them warm enough so they wouldn't freeze sometimes, so that they could come out, and that was one of the first things that they planted. As you're kind of setting and clearing the area, whether or not you were in a forested area, or I can't even imagine making your house out of, buffalo cow patties and buffalo grass, but you would try to do anything to make a living off of that 180 or 160 acres. And so one of the first things that they would do is plant a tree. And I love this because, in spring of 1878, several families started to move into Clark's Fork Valley, which I will talk about. One of the foremost persons was Orson Nickerson Newman. What a cool name. Former Justice of the Peace in Madison County and so on. But at the very bottom it says, arrived in 1878 along with 35 head of cattle, 3 yoke of oxen, and 3 teams of horses. So those were very important. The animals were very important. But does anybody see anything in that picture that just made me go, wow, that is so cool? Because you can see the branches of an apple tree right here. You can see another branch of an apple tree. So as they were coming out, one of the very first things that they would do is plant these apple trees, because they knew it would take 3 to 5 years to start getting fruit. So it was very important to get them established right away. in these orchards. And they had a time of it, trying to get apple trees established. I can tell you from experience, trying to get them started in Montana is not always easy. And just as soon as you start to get a nice orchard, things like winter kill, or in this case, a large flood that came out and took out their orchard, it was tough times to try to get started with fruit. So as we're settling in the West, one of the major innovations that we had, obviously, was train travel. And I bring this up because part of the history that I'm going to show you on a couple of these orchards, it was very important. The train travel that we had through Montana at the time was very important for setting up a lot of these orchards that I look at today. But what's really interesting is that if you look at old postcards, if you look at history, the historical pamphlets and postcards that trying to get people to come to the West, to come to these different areas, and even though this isn't an old postcard, but they always had an orchard. There was a picture of an apple tree. This was a very important thing to them because at the time when they're settling the West, having apple trees in the picture meant that this was this was prosperity. This was good, fertile land, and they would draw people to areas because of these apple trees that were in these pictures. And you almost always see some kind of promotion, and I'll show you a few of them, about having these historic apples, apple trees in the pictures. I mean, here's a great example. I got to tell you, every time you look at like pictures and you go through family albums at the time, from the turn of the century through the 1930s, they were almost always in an orchard. It's very odd to see. They were in front of the house, but there was always one of those pictures. Let's go out to the orchard and take a picture. So this was, just by looking at the vehicle, early 1900s. You can see a new planting here and an older planting, but that's right in the orchard. Here again is another great picture. This was prosperity. This means that, hey, we're making it. We're doing well. I love this picture. The kids are basically buried in apples, having a time. Why would the kids love the apples? What do you think? Sugar. There wasn't much sweet to eat. This was like their candy. This was their dessert. And so, the kids loved it. I love this picture. It's one of my favorites. I mean, here's this kind of old, crusty guy that looks like he should be a miner, and he's so proud of his apple trees, and he's probably really proud of those apple trees because it's not about the sugar for candy. It was for the sugar for that hard apple cider because, quite honestly, when you came to the West, there wasn't anything you could make alcohol out of, right? We think about beer with our barley and our wheat and the hops. We didn't have those. Potatoes, maybe, but really apples. It was really easy to make alcohol. And so, the whole Johnny Appleseed. I love the fact that everybody thinks that Johnny Appleseed was this great person that went around and, planted apples everywhere for all the kids to eat all the apples. That's how I learned it, right? But little did you know that he is actually planting apples so that people could have alcohol. He was the very first alcohol distributor in the U.S. This is a great picture, and the reason why I put this up here is that you can see here Dad, Mom, and Carl in the orchard in 1936. You see a lot of these pictures, and why this really resonates with me is this is Brent Sarchet, my colleague's great-grandparents in the orchard. When they came out west. Again, another picture of them in the orchard. You can see the orchard boxes and in the background. So this was something that was important to him and his family. And again, one of my favorite pictures. I mean, you can find pictures after pictures of people standing in orchards. It was, again, the prosperity. That I just love. In Montana, we have a very rich history in apple production and fruit production. If you look over here, you see that Montana apples, they were Hamilton, Montana, Bitterroot Valley apples. We had actually a very large industry in Montana. We produced Macintosh and Wealthy apples and shipped them all over the country. Up until about the 1920s. This is another one, Ross Orchards. This was an old, John Ross is an orchardist that's up in Fromberg. He still uses the old logo that they had from Fromberg back in the day. So if you look at these, some of these areas all the way up to Bitterroot, and then if you go up 93, you get into the cherries. But in the Bitterroot Valley, this was where most of the apple production is, and this is where we see a lot of the apple production still today in Montana. And one of the things that Brent and I are trying to do is to try to figure out how to get more apple production outside of the Bitterroot area so we can grow in these, like, what I call fruit deserts, places where people don't grow a whole lot of fruit. But we know that the Bitterroot Valley, all the way from Missoula, all the way down to Sula, is a large area where we produce apples. This right here is an orchard that I just visited, and it's a cider, hard cider orchard that was put in 5 years ago for Western Cider. So people are putting in some new orchards, but, you know, it's an amazing spot. This was what the Bitterroot Valley looked like. And I don't know the age of this picture, but there were all it was, you know, now it's a lot of houses and ranchettes. But at the time, it was a perfect place to grow apples. And one of the reasons why that is that Marcus Daly, I believe, built what they call, they still call it the ditch. And it's a large irrigation ditch that goes all across the rim of the Bitterroot Valley that supports irrigation to a lot of different folks. And because you can put these orchards on a little bit of a slope so the air would move through it and you had water, it was a great place to grow apple orchards. And so you can see some new starting, older apple orchards. Here is the town of Darby. If you can imagine what Darby looks like now, it was pretty much all orchards. And if you look at this, during the Bitterroot apple boom, which was in the early 1900s, orchards increased to 300 apple trees by 1900. By 1920, there were 750,000 apple trees in the Bitterroot Valley alone. That's pretty amazing when you think about how many trees were in the area, over 10,000 acres of apples. So what happened? Well, one thing happened was World War I. World War I stopped a lot of apple production because we simply did not have the manpower or the people power to take care of those orchards. Number two, codling moth came in. Codling moth is the proverbial worm in the apple in Montana, and we did not really know what to do to take care of codling moth. So once a codling moth gets in, the larva gets into the apple, it doesn't ship well. It rots in transit. And so we lost a lot of that, a lot of our orchards due to that. Also, Washington was ramping up and growing a lot more apples than we were. And so that's why the apple production really went from Montana to Washington during that time. And so predominantly, most of our apples still come from Washington to this day. Here is a, this was a postcard-type publication for people to come to the Bitterroot Valley. Again, one of those things, look what we can grow here. We can grow apples. And so it was a nice, fertile place. People wanted to move to the Bitterroot Valley. We still have some old orchards. This is Swanson's Orchard, both in the middle of winter and also flowering. This orchard is still in production. It's over 100 years old. These trees are old trees that still produce. So we do have some bigger orchards that are producing. Over here, you see Ross Orchards in Fromberg, Montana, and plenty of you are probably thinking, where the heck is Fromberg, Montana? But if you go south of Billings, so if you actually south of Laurel down to Belfry, this whole area is the Clark Fork Valley. And the Clark Fork Valley was another huge area where we produced a ton of apples, not just in the Bitterroot. A lot of people will consider the Bitterroot a place where we grew apples, but we grew a lot down the Clark Fork Valley. In fact, Ross Orchards, this was 1943. This is John Ross, and John Ross is retired. His father planted those in 1943, and he planted these in 1980. He has over 300 trees, I think, that he still sells apples in Fromberg. It's right in the town of Fromberg. So if you want to go see an orchard in Montana, drive to Fromberg. You can't miss it, okay? Fromberg's not, you blink and you miss the town. So if you just look around, you will see the orchard there and produces a lot of great apples in that area. Another really interesting spot for all of you, since we're here in the Gallatin Valley, our neighbors to the east of us, there was also a huge amount of production. I wouldn't say huge, but a large amount of production from Livingston down to Gardner, which is very, very cool. Livingston used to have a very large orchard. If you drive through Livingston on your, if you go through Livingston on your way out to the last exit, all through there was a very large orchard. And I work with Chris. He works at the post office here at MSU. And there's still some remnants of those old trees on that property. I've gone from there to Immigrant. I was just at Arrow Peak, which is one of the orchards that we're working with. It's up in Mill Creek. Gardner, Montana. So in Gardner, Montana, if you drive through this main street of Gardner, Montana, it's called Scott Street to anybody in Gardner. Scott Street was named after the Scott Ranch, which was the very first ranch in Gardner. And now it's surrounded by houses. But the old orchard is still in the front yard of somebody's house. And there's still, I think, 12 trees that are still producing in that area. So imagine how old that one is. So we look at all the history that happens with the orchards and what we're and why we got so excited about this, because this is where I get excited. Like, the history's cool, but when it comes down to, like, whoa, the neat things that we're finding, the science that we're finding from this is really a lot of fun. So we have the Montana Heritage Orchard Program. And the way that this works is that trees must be, we started out with trees must be 50 years or older, and we found out that, well, there's a lot of orchards that are 50 years and older. So we actually changed that to 100 years or older. So the John Ross orchard that was planted in 1943 went out of our orchard, our heritage program, because it wasn't old enough. You must have at least 6 living trees still remaining in the orchard. And the reason why we went with 6 trees is we seriously did not want to go to every backyard tree that was over 100 years old. But let me back up. We really wanted to go to every backyard tree, but that put some sideboards on us so that we weren't a little bit crazy. And then the landowner's willingness to work with us with the research to allow us on the property to do the research that we wanted to do. So we're looking for old, unique, or new cultivars, which we'll talk about. Propagating trees from Montana nurseries, which is kind of the last thing we'll talk about. And then we're going to be grafting some of these old cultivars. So I'll kind of go through some of the history, some of the reasons why we do this, some of the exciting things that I'm looking at when we kind of go through this. But when you look at grafting, right? So why do we graft apples? Okay, so apples on the left-hand side, Honeycrisp, right? What do you guys think of Honeycrisp? Great apples, right? So good. I always laugh about it because I think it's psychosomatic. I've had apples that are far superior to Honeycrisp apples. And sometimes I think because of the word honey and crisp, we're like, they're so good. And really what's odd about it is that everybody wants a Honeycrisp apple. And Honeycrisp apples are one of those that we've tried in our study that really don't do well. They're really hard to get established in Montana. In all 10 orchards, really difficult to get established, except for in Columbia Falls, which makes a little more sense. It's up there in that kind of temperate area, more of a rainforest type situation. But, okay, so we all like the granny or the Honeycrisp apples. Now, if we take that apple, we open it up, and we take the seeds out of that, and we plant that out, and the trees grow and they produce apples, what are we going to get? Not Honeycrisp apples, okay? Apples are totally different than us, right? I look like my dad. I mean, I have the genetics of my mom and my dad. I look like my dad. I act like my mom. Apples are totally different. You have the two-parent material that comes together, and because they need to have pollination from totally different types of animal or apples, so you need the pollen from completely different types of apples to fertilize that, that they have such strange genetics that you plant out 1,000 seeds and you might get one apple from one of those trees that slightly resembles a Honeycrisp. The rest of them will be green, hard, horrible, crunchy, terrible apples. Okay? So we don't propagate apples by seed. Okay? So we have to propagate them through what we call asexual reproduction, cloning. So we take scion wood, we take that new growth from those trees, we take rootstock, and I'm not going to get into rootstock and scion, but we have rootstock for certain reasons, like how high the tree gets, how hardy the tree is. And then we take the desirable apple, we take a bud, and we graft it onto the new rootstock. Okay? So we're taking the exact same DNA right off that tree. So let me back up. You take a houseplant, you cut it, you put it in water, and then you put it into a pot. It's got the exact same DNA as that mother houseplant. It's the same plant, right? Same concept with this. We're taking a bud off of this and putting it on there. It has the same genetics, okay? And here's how we do it. Here is our rootstock. We take a chip out of there. We take a chip out of our cyanwood, the apple that we're trying to get, the desirable apple, that Honeycrisp apple. Here's that chip. We insert it into the rootstock. We let that grow. Here's the old tree that we cut off, okay? So we're going to cut this off like here, let this bud grow, and this is the new tree, okay? So with that being said, every Honeycrisp apple tree on the face of the planet has the exact same DNA. They're clones of one another, okay? I bring this up because it's a very important when it comes to some of the things that we're looking at. So we're perpetuating clones. Every one of these trees in this orchard, if they're the same cultivar, have the exact same DNA. And that's how we can separate, you know, these the golden delicious maybe from the red delicious apples. Does that make sense? Okay. All right, so with that, we have cultivars. And with that cultivar is a plant that has been produced and cultivated by selective breeding. In other words, we have to keep that line going, or else if we don't, then we will lose that cultivar, okay? So we have to keep it going. So if you think about all of the different apples that are out there, which there are literally thousands of apples, or close to, that are different kinds of apples that are out there, we've actually, because once a tree that is a certain cultivar, if that tree and all the trees like it die, then we no longer have that apple ever again on the face of the planet. It is gone, okay? So we have lost more apples off the face of the planet than we have apples today. So we've lost some great cultivars out there. We've lost some amazing apples. Ones that, there was one that I read about, they call it the billion-dollar apple. It's described in the Apples of New York in 1909 as one of the best hard cider apples. The pros about this have people like giddy about finding this apple. There are gentlemen that are running up and down the East Coast trying to find this apple, because if they do find it, because of how they think this will actually affect the hard cider industry, that apple could be worth $1 billion. That's how crazy it is. But we think it's gone. It may be completely gone. So what's going on now is that we're kind of against time. We want to make sure that we can find some of these old cultivars that might be in some of these old orchards. So what's out there? What's in these Montana orchards, these 100-year-old orchards? What did people plant? What did they bring with them? There's an account, and I'll show you the orchard, of a gentleman that came over in 1915, from Poland. He came from Poland. He settled with his 160 acres in Radersburg, Montana, in the Crow Creek area. What did he bring with him? Did he have apples when he came across the pond? Did he have apples with him that he brought from the mother country that we have no idea that could still be here in Montana, still growing in these old orchards? It's kind of cool to think about. We might find one of these old cultivars. But how do we know? Well, we know because of Dr. Norm Whedon, okay? And I love that I'm doing a history project, because if anybody knows Norm, that's an old picture of Norm that I found. I was like, whoa, he's awfully young in that picture. But what we do is we take, so if you look at a tree, you can tell the difference between fruit buds and leaf buds. But we will take these off usually in February and March. We put them in water, or he puts them in water, and they leaf out, and we can find the DNA. See, people for literally decades have been trying to figure out, Orville McCarver was out trying to figure out what these different types of apples were. And what's interesting is that Orville McCarver, my predecessor, Dr. Bob Goff, they had an idea of, this is a Macintosh type apple, but I can't tell you the exact cultivar. Or this is a delicious type apple, because there's really nobody out there, even by taste, by look, can definitively tell you that that's what kind of cultivar an apple it is. People are really good at it. My colleague, Brent Sarche, is really good at it. He can buy an apple and goes, that's a wealthy. He can buy another one, that's a Macintosh. He knows. But some of these weird ones, he doesn't quite know. So we have to do DNA testing. And what's really fun about being where we're at right now is that we can do the DNA testing on these trees to figure out what kind of cultivar they are. Oh, Super cool. Okay, so what we do is we take that new bud, we put it in water, just like a pussy willow, right? We put it in water, it buds out because it's real clean DNA. Then Norm takes it, and he does his magic and looks at little bars and things. I am not a geneticist. I do not understand what they do. But they compare it to other DNA, which we went out and found what we thought grew at that time from the late 1800s to 1950. We took every apple we could imagine, and we took the DNA from those, and we compared them to try to find what these cultivars are. So we find a lot of apples that we know of. This is a wealthy. Wealthy is the most predominant apple that was planted during the time from probably 1906 to 1910. That was the biggest time period in which we were planting apples. We find wealthy everywhere in these old orchards. In fact, everybody's been asking, are you going to bring apples? Are you going to bring apples? When you go out today, because the only apple I could find, and it was pouring rain, was I have about a half a box of wealthy out there, and every one of you can take one home and try a wealthy apple. But it was the apple of the time. Macintosh, wealthy and Macintosh. You hear about the Bitterroot blend of apple cider, because they used to press ciders. You always hear about this Bitterroot blend. It was an apple cider blend that they kept in secret in the Bitterroot for years until finally somebody let it go that it was just two parts wealthy and one part Macintosh. And that's because that's what they grew in the area. This is a yellow transparent. You all probably have seen these. These are very common in a lot of backyards or in orchards. There are those yellow ones that usually are very ripe, very early, very soft. Once they fall off the tree, you better get them before they melt into the ground. But they're very common. This one, what does it look like? Granny Smith. This is a Northwest Greening. If you like Granny Smith apple, you should be planting a Northwest Greening, because I honestly can bite into a Granny Smith and bite into a Northwest Greening and cannot tell the difference between the two. They are almost exactly alike. But this was grown since the 1800s here in Montana. This is a yellow Transcendent Crab. We see these all over. What do you think Transcendent Crabs were used for? Kind of hard to peel and make into apple pies. Yeah, these were definitely hard cider apples, for sure. And then this one. This is one of my favorites that's out there, and it's a very common one. So this is not it. This is a wealthy. This is what I pulled from the box. And I was out at an orchard today where they know the different cultivars. So this is a normal wealthy apple. This is one that we see that's very common. The one that I have that's up there is a Wolf River. Wolf River was grown for its size. Look at the size of that apple. And that's about the size that the Wolf Rivers would get even back in the day. Very large, great apple. And we find those out there, quite often. So it's kind of fun to see some of these old cultivars. So of the hundreds of heirloom apples that are grown at the time, we're only finding a few of them. And I got to tell you, what's going on with the genetics, which is so much fun, is that we have a list. We know which ones. So if I have an orchard that has 25 trees, we can say, 1, 3, 5, and 7 of all these orchards, because we got them numbered, are wealthy. And these are Macintosh, and these are Northwest Greening. But then we have unique, and it comes down the list. Well, what does unique mean? That means that it has absolutely no genetic, it's not genetically paired with any other tree that we have found in all of Montana. That's exciting, right? That's when you're like, oh, did we find an old cultivar? Is it possible that we found an old cultivar? Because we only put the ones out there that we knew were grown at the time. So there could be all of these ones that are taken from England, from all through Europe. Who knows? Or it could just be the rootstock, because a lot of times the rootstock was just seed that they put out, and then they grew it on the seed. So we don't really know. So my job right now is to go all across the state, try to look at these apples and see if they're decent apples. Here's something I just found on the internet when I was looking. 75 heirloom apple varieties you've never heard of, because you probably haven't heard of a lot of those apples that are out there that are quite unique. I mean, we find apples. There's one, which I'll tell you about, that's they call it the Montana banana. I was like, oh, come on, it doesn't taste like a banana. It tastes like a banana. It's crazy. You find some really cool ones out there. And then we're also looking for chance seedlings. So we're looking for the old cultivars. We're looking for lost cultivars. And then we're looking for chance seedlings, those ones where we know were not planted. And I'll show you some pictures of some. Because chance seedlings, and it is a very much of a chance, it's kind of a one in a million. But at sometimes the genetics in these seeds, which were usually dispersed by these guys, which I got to tell you, I've been to three different orchards where I had to carry bear spray. Because they were crazy. I've never seen so much bear poo. And when you see bear poo like this, you know they're eating apples because it seems like it's only in them for about 5 minutes before it comes out the other end. But yeah, chance seedlings, these ones that we find down the creek, down the irrigation ditch, along the fence because somebody threw them out. We find a lot of these, and I'm very excited about a few that we've seen. I also have to put a shout out because I know there's a couple people here that have helped quite a bit, Frank and Tom. Raise your hands, guys. Anybody else help prune these old trees? Master gardeners come out and they help prune these old, gnarly, huge apple trees that have been there for 100 years. That, I believe, is a 14-foot ladder, 12-foot ladder anyways. And I believe that's Frank right there. Isn't that you, Frank? I think it is. They come out and they prune these gnarly old trees and help out. So the other part of what we do in this program is help them with water, nutrients, trying to get these things reinvigorated so that we can keep them going because we do lose a bunch of them. So what I'm going to do is kind of to go through a brief tour of some of the sites because there's some history, there's some fun things to look at, some of the things that I'm really excited about. And then at the end, I'll take some questions. So are you ready to go on a tour? Some of the cool places that we found? Okay, who knows where that is? Do you? Where is it? That's a Spring Hill Pavilion. How many of you have gone? You're in the Gallatin Valley. How many of you have gone to a wedding at Spring Hill Pavilion? We've all been there, right? We've all been there. And what you don't recognize is look in the background. And when you look in the background, there's these huge apple trees that a lot of people don't even realize. They're all caught up in the wedding. And so met up with Chum Howe, who owns this property. There's 22 apple trees that, weirdly enough, this property, the plat for this property was 1860. Okay, so think about 1860. And the name on the plat was the Nielsen Fruit Farm. Those trees have been there probably they were planted between 1860 and 1870. I just got goosebumps. That's some cool stuff, right? What the heck did they plant? What kind of trees did they plant there? How are they living up there by Ross Peak? Because this is actually the Ross Peak Ranch. It's just fascinating. Here it is, right? Here's the barn. Here's their house. Here's the pavilion. Here's where the little cook area. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. There's trees all over. This is a picture from 1964. You can actually see they're in a row. And here's two more. So there was rows upon rows upon rows upon rows of trees in the Spring Hill Pavilion. Did anybody know that? I had no idea. I've been to weddings there. I never saw the apple trees. I was too worried about where my next beer was coming from. This is the coolest one. This is where what we're really working on right now as far as kind of our first line, and I'll talk about that. So Chief Plenitoku State Park, we got this call. Hey, you got to come out and take a look at this. You got to come out to Pryor, Montana. Where the heck is Pryor, Montana, right? So you got to come out and take a look at this. Find out that Chief Plenitoku in 1903, so Chief Plenitoku went to Washington, D.C., and there's two ways, we've heard two different stories. So, again, not a historian. This is why we need historians. But either he had a vision and said, I need to plant as many fruit trees as I possibly can, or was told, you will plant as many fruit trees as you possibly can. We don't really know, but Chief Plenitoku planted an orchard in Pryor at Chief Plenitoku State Park. So if you go back around the creek, you find what was 6, now there are 5. We've already lost one. It's really sad. Of these trees that Chief Plenitoku planted in 1903. We did the DNA testing on these trees. We did pruning, first of all. This is Master Gardeners. Sometimes this is what it looks like when we're out volunteering and pruning in these locations because we prune in the winter. But there they are. There's five. I think there's one sixth one. And these came out to be Duchess and Wealthy. So right off the bat, we could care less about the fact that these are common. Because what we're doing is we took the Scion wood off of these because they were planted in 1903. They were planted by Chief Planning Coup. We took the Scion wood, we bud grafted this to modern rootstock. We have over 100 of them that will be released next year that will say that these are Chief Planning Coup, Duchess, and Wealthy apple trees. So it was trees that were sourced in Montana. We found the budwood in Montana. We grew it in Montana, Canyon View Nursery, and they will be sold at local nurseries. What's cool about that? Because it's a story about Chief Planning Coup and planting these apple trees. What's another cool thing about that? Genetics. Even though that this tree right here might be a Wealthy, the old propagators will tell you that even though they all have the exact same DNA, right? Wealthies should have all the same DNA. Because they have been in the harsh climate since 1903 of droughts, winter temperatures that go on forever, cold temperatures, all of these different situations, that they're hardier than the Wealthies that you would get anywhere else, okay? Because ecotypically, so we have the genetically they're all the same, but what they say is, and again, I'm not a geneticist, but ecotypically, there may be a gene that switches on or off. They're a tougher tree. And so the whole idea is that these trees, because we're grafting from these trees, the trees that you plant may be a tougher tree than the ones you would get from, let's say, one of the big box stores, which is kind of cool. The other thing that's really cool about this, when we go out and look at these trees, is we're looking for mutations. We're looking for what we call spores. Anything, one of these branches, sometimes the apples might be darker on one side and lighter on the other, bigger, more resilient to disease. Maybe a whole different apple, which we have not found yet, but that would be the coolest thing because that's a totally huge mutation that's happened in that tree. And so the whole idea is that we're finding disease resistance, hardiness, all of those things that we're grafting onto modern rootstock from this. So you will be able to, you will see and maybe get your hands on a Chief Planning Coup Duchess apple in spring of 2019. From our program. So what happens with that is that we're taking the Scion, we're grafting it, we're selling it, there's a small royalty on there. The royalty is split half with Chief Planning Coup State Park and half with our program. So it gives them money to take care of the orchard and it gives us money to keep this program going. Because we don't want to be stuck on grants the whole time. We want this thing to, you know, perpetuate itself. Crow Creek, this is in Radersburg. Anybody know where Radersburg is, right? So if you're driving from Three Forks to Helena, and if you kind of look off to the left in that dry, kind of horrible area down there where you didn't think that there's an apple tree that could grow, there's actually, we call it Crow Creek 1 and Crow Creek 2 because both of them call themselves the Crow Creek Ranch, which I think is interesting. But this is the first one we found. I don't have pictures of the other one. But look at all of these old apple trees. Now this was, again, his name was Toma that settled this area. They think that he was an Americanized name. Toma probably came from Tomowitz, which was probably Polish. But he came all the way from Poland and settled in Radersburg and planted this orchard. We figured about 1915 was about the date. Amazing old trees, just still producing, doing really, really well. An amazing kind of, weirdly enough, the creek, Crow Creek floods, it gets water. And this is in the spring where it's getting tons of water. And then it shuts off completely and only gets rainfall from that point on. There's no irrigation. So these trees are really hardy and fantastic looking out there. We were really excited about what's in this orchard because of the climate that they're in. We think they're going to do quite well. When you look at some of these old trees, they're not always in the best shape. Here you can see this only living part of this tree is right here And on this side, this is all dead. Look at this poor tree. There's probably about 4 inches of growth on the back side that's supporting those 2 or 3 stems up there. We see some pretty gnarly trees that are still surviving in these areas. And again, we have master gardeners and volunteers that come out and help. And I do want to kind of point out part of this for the landowners is they get a sign. This one's got a little typo problem, but they get a sign that they can put on their property. So it's a little bit about agritourism too. People that are goofy about apples like Brent and I can go and, you know, contact these folks, see if they can get some sign wood themselves if they're so willing, and come see some of these old trees. This is McMaster's Orchard. So if you're driving from Bozeman or from Townsend and you're going to Helena, once you get through Winston, so you drive right through the town of Winston, you go through the bottom where all the trees are, and you come back up, look to your right. There's a little ranch up there, and I didn't know anything about it. I passed by that all the time, never even seemed to look. And there is a ranch up there that has all these old trees. So Dolly McMaster, here she is pictured. It's the only picture I have of her, got it off the internet. She's in her 90s. Her great-grandfather, I think, settled the property. They were blacksmiths, and before they had Canyon Ferry Reservoir, where they would have the wagon trains come through was right through their property. So train wagons would break all the time going across the river, and so they would fix the wagons as they came out going both ways. She showed the house that she lived in, or that they lived in originally. It was a 10-by-10 rock structure. That's what they originally lived in. It's still on the property. It's amazing. Cool place to see. And I got to tell you stories. I mean, it's so much fun. I mean, the history is amazing to see all of these different places. But Dolly, I laugh because I see the satellite dish, and it makes me laugh because I'm like, oh man, she has a satellite dish. Because here we are, we're all out pruning. We're all, you know, here in this, you know, country where it's not a great place for apple trees. We're all pruning away. We get done, and Brent says, well, Dolly, why don't you tell us about our orchard? Well, to her, it was like, tell us all about the ranch. So she goes on about the ranch, and well, tell us about, you know, you and this orchard. Well, she starts talking, and she says, well, you know, things have changed since I was younger. She's like, I'm starting to kind of get a little bit more involved in, you know, modern times. And she says, I finally went down and bought one of those electric stoves. And I'm like looking at people going, did she just say what? An electric stove? She had been cooking on wood heat her entire life up until 2 years ago. And she said, I like that electric stove so much, I went down and bought myself one of those electric water heaters. I kid you not. Dolly is an amazing person. She never married. She never has kids. She's lived by herself her whole entire life. And she has this orchard. She will outwork anybody that's out there at her age. Amazing. Great property. By the way, when we do this, we chip everything, leave it on site. It's kind of cool. This one is the Darby area. This one was one of our first orchards we found. It's 13 miles up Rye Creek. So you think Darby was an area where they grew a huge amount of apple orchards, but this was 13 miles up this kind of gnarly road to get up there, and we find this huge orchard for us, you know, starting out, 47 trees, and hardly any of them are the same tree. So somebody was like, I'm going to try this, and they're the true scientists. We're going to try all of these different kinds of apples that are out there, and really amazing looking old trees. Here's, you know, one that's in the orchard. Ah, we go down in the creek bank and we find this amazing old tree that was not part of the orchard. There's no way it was planted. It was across the road in the creek. So obviously, one of our chance seedlings. We're very excited about this apple. Obviously, we can't do any DNA testing because nobody has the DNA on this, not even Cornell. But we're going to start looking at this apple. We've taken some of the cyanwood, grafted it ourselves, and we're going to try and see what kind of apple this produces because it's actually kind of amazing. We see a lot of things out there. This was White Deer Ranch. This was in Fishtail. We pulled up to this and went, oh my gosh, they have hogs in the orchard. Are they crazy? What are they doing? And this is what spurs a whole bunch of more research, is like weed control in orchards is really difficult. It's one of the hardest things that any orchardist has to deal with. there's not a weed in this. I mean, hogs are the best little rototillers you will ever find. And weirdly enough, they left the trunks alone. The trunks were perfectly fine. We did find out, though, that they left the hogs in there a little too long. And because of the salts, we actually lost a few of the trees. But I don't think it was... I'm like, wow, let's do a research project where we put hogs in orchards and see if they'd take care of it. It might work, right? The diamond mine. Now, going back to history, this is near Diamond City. It's on the other side of Canyon Ferry Lake. And quite a few trees, even cherries. If you look at Diamond City, it was on the other side of Canyon Ferry Reservoir. And Diamond City was where the diamond mine was. And a lot of folks don't understand that there was a mine there that housed over 1,000 people at one time up in Diamond City. And so what people did at the time was grew an orchard, an 80-acre orchard, to support the fruit of both plums, cherries, pears, apples, for the miners up in Diamond City, which was kind of amazing. And you see these apple trees and cherry trees sporadically through this area. Most of them that are doing well is in an irrigated lawn. And actually, I had to have my mug boots on because it was so wet out there. But they're doing pretty well. We do see some, you know, pretty nice trees. We see some pretty gnarly old trees. I believe this is a pear. But we see trees that completely split down the middle and still growing. Look at, there's just so little growing on this tree. We want to make sure that, and again, talk about hardy, living in this area and still producing. But this is where it comes down to some of those, like, what can we find from these? So historically, we know that these trees have been here since the Diamond City mine era, which was turn of the century. These trees have been here long enough. These are Rocky Mountain junipers. And if you know anything about having Rocky Mountain junipers around apple trees, that's a no bueno type situation. You don't want them around because what happens is the junipers, through cedar apple rust, this is a teleohorn that dries out and sporulates, and then it goes over to the apple and it can cause the disease of apples. It's also the hawthorn rust that went probably about 15 years ago took out most of the hawthorns here in the Gallatin Valley. So it's a very similar type situation. Yet, if you go back to this picture, they're growing amongst junipers. And when I was in the junipers, I found teleohorns all over the junipers. We didn't see hardly an infection of cedar apple rust in any of the trees. Here's an apple tree. The junipers are growing underneath it. And yet the tree is totally fine, totally... There's not one spot of cedar apple rust. So what does that tell me? Either this is super resistant to cedar apple rust, or something genetically happened that made this ecotypically resistant to cedar apple rust. That's awesome. Okay, so disease resistance. Wealthy, another one. We know it is moderately susceptible to fire blight. Fire blight is rampant throughout Montana. We see these old wealthy apple trees that have fire blight, then grows right through it, still producing apples. That's awesome for somebody like myself, because there is a potential that if you could figure out the genes for this and you could cross it or genetically modify it to have an apple in somebody's backyard that gets fire blight, but who cares? Because it's going to grow through it. That's huge, because that's what I answer almost all the questions about. What do I do about fire blight? What do I do about fire blight? And at this point in time, our only recommendation is to prune 6 to 12 inches below the infection, which in some trees means you're doing the Montana prune and you're cutting 6 inches out the ground, taking the tree out. So we see resistance to a lot of different things out there. You can imagine sometimes we pull up to areas and this is what we have to prune out. So we're doing a lot of pruning, but we're trying to keep this tree going. Once you take out a lot of this old, dead stuff, the trees really do respond. We've seen a lot of response. In fact, I was just at Arrow Peak, which was one of our orchards. We pruned it 2 years ago. It's like, you got to come back because the growth is, the epicormic growth, the real fast growth, is growing so fast. He was like, I'm kind of worried that we're going to have to cut some of that back. It's getting a little bit too big. And it was. It was quite amazing. I only show you this picture. I don't know where it's at. I think Brent wants to keep it to himself, 1890s. But there's no way that that tree was planted there, okay? It was thrown out the window with the mash, right? and this is the apple. Now, that's a smaller apple. It's not big. But we find this in old apple trees that have poor nutrition. A lot of times, these Wolf Rivers that you would find in some of these are only this big. So that it's normally this big, but because of nutrition, we'll find Wolf Rivers that are quite small. So we're looking at this apple. It's got some marketability. It's shiny. It's waxy. It'll last for a long time. What does it taste like? Brent goes and tastes this, and he's like, oh, my God, this is the best apple I've had in a long time. Had this, like, sprightly kind of floral. It was just amazing little apple. So we've propagated this. He's got it in his orchard, and we're going to try to see if we can get this with nutrition, a little bit bigger apple, a better apple. Wild Horse Island. So if you go on the Flathead, you go to Wild Horse Island, it's the largest island on Flathead Lake, and it's a big island, I'm going to tell you, because you have to walk about 3/4 to a mile to get to this orchard. This orchard is about 3/4 of the way up the island, on literally Wild Horse Island. I have to laugh because the horses aren't that wild, especially when you're in an orchard with apples. Wild Horse Islands, or wild horses, are over top of your shoulders saying, what are you doing? What are you doing? So I'm totally freaked out because it says keep at least 100 feet away from the horses at all times. And the horses are like, you know, you're trying to get away. And they're like, no, you got apples, man. What are you doing? It is really kind of freaky. So here's the orchard that is amongst a lot of the pines that are up there in a very dry and horrible situation, really, for growing trees. We actually went up and took these fence posts and put them up around the tree, not necessarily to keep the horses from eating the apples, but to keep the horses from rubbing against the trunk. We found that they're rubbing against the trunk, all the living tissues on the outside, and it was affecting them. So we hauled, because there's no motorized vehicles on Wild Horse Island, we hauled every one of these up a mile up there on our shoulder and walked back down and picked up another one. It was, luckily we had some help with Master Gardeners, Montana Conservation Corps, and Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, but it took a while. There are transcendent crabs, there are pears, and there are Macintosh and Wealthy apples on the island, which is very cool. This tree right here, I want to show you this tree. This tree fell here. This was a branch that now grew another whole tree. We see these things. It's crazy. Got to tell you a funny story about this, though, with the horse. This is how close we can get to them, because they're 100 feet away, whatever. When you're in the orchard, they know it. So when we first started, we found this orchard. This is probably like the 6th or 7th one that we found across the state. And we would find one apple way up there, and we'd take a stick, and we'd throw it up there, and we'd take a rock, and we'd throw it up there, and luckily if we hit the apple, and the apple would fall out of the tree, and like, yay, we got the apple, we could look at it. And then we got to Wild Horse Island, and we're like, oh, there's an apple. We're throwing sticks up there and throwing rocks up there, and this horse goes over and grabs the branch and goes, and the apple falls from the tree. Brent and I are like, I'll be damned. We just learned something from a horse. That's so cool. So now whenever we want to find those apples, we just shake the tree really hard and they fall out of the tree. We were kind of naive when we first started. We really didn't know what we were doing. Woods Ranch. This one is up in Eureka. Eureka is, I got to pull, see if this works. Yeah, this is in Eureka, Montana. This is an interesting property in the fact that when they dammed the river, the Kootenai River and the Kookanoosa Lake, whatever, I don't actually really know the names, they actually took over this property. This used to be the Woods Ranch, and through eminent domain, took over the ranch so that they could have a wildlife management area for the deer and the elk. Can you imagine how you would feel about that? No wonder when you go up to that part of the country, they hate the government. When they see our trucks coming up, I'm kind of scared. I'm not going to lie to you. It's a government truck. But there was an orchard. There's an amazing orchard up here. And I took video of it. And here is the video. It's an amazing amount of trees that were here. So I'm doing a panoramic video of this. And you can see back over here, these are an amazing amount of trees. And there's hazelnuts up here. It's not just apples. We found hazelnuts. We found lots of different, that's a truck. That's us. They're huge. Huge orchard. Very cool place. And so we found this, and then Brent, he's pretty energetic, so he walked up over top of the mountain and found an identical orchard up there. There's two of them. There's no way we can do all the genetic testing. Each tree, on average, costs between $100 and $150 a tree to do the genetic testing. So it costs a lot to do this. We can't. So we got to go up to Eureka and camp sometime and figure out which apple trees we want to genetically test when we know a little bit more about the area. Sunny Slope Orchard. Oh, this is a cool place. Now, this kind of comes back to history again. Jim and Carol, when I ended up at the property, they're like, okay, let's take the four-wheelers. Four-wheelers. Okay, we'll take the four-wheelers. That sounds like fun. Little did I know I would be on a four-wheeler for 2.5 hours riding around with them. They're really cool people at the Springbrook Ranch. They raise yaks and weird animals of all kinds. And they're super cool people, some of the nicest people you ever wanted to meet. And they drove me around the property. Over 1,000-acre orchard that was planted in the 1870s. 1,000-acre orchard. Imagine that. When we went up there, we found these apple trees with these huge piles of rocks. Imagine the manpower it took to clear all the rocks out of that area. We'd find literally hundreds of piles of rocks like this. We found apple trees in every location. We were trying to figure out how old an apple tree is, right? So how do you figure out how old a tree is?
Core.
You core it. The problem is an apple tree, you can't core it. They're hollow inside or they're rotten inside. So you count the rings. Well, I stopped counting. It's an 8-year-old tree, right? Because there's nothing. It's all dead inside. It's rotten, so we can't core it. Ah, but what we could do was core the ponderosa pines. And the ponderosa pines are 95 years old. That means that there's no way they would have had ponderosa pines growing amongst this orchard. So that probably took a couple decades for the ponderosa pines to start growing and start developing in this orchard. So we figured that this was grown probably started about 1860s, 1870s in the Kalispell area. Okay? That has some significance to it. Again, look at these old trees amongst these huge ponderosa pines. Okay? Driving around, you just see these pockets of orchards. And then we find the ghost orchards. This scares me because these are trees we're losing in the area, mostly due to drought. Look at this. You can see them in the line in a row. You know that they were planted intentionally. And I did a Google image. It was so much fun. These are apple trees. All these little guys, apple trees, apple trees, apple trees. And when you do a Google image, you see the rows in amongst it, over 1,000 acres. Okay, so think to yourself, who would have the manpower to plant 1,000 acres of trees in the 1870s? The railroad. I told you I'd come back to a railroad. The railroad, right? So here's the thing that happened with this. We were going back and trying to figure out why in the world they would plant that many trees. And the railroad was trying to come through, and they wanted the town of Kalispell. And then there was barge traffic that was coming up the river, and they wanted the town of, I think it's called Marion. And they had this big fight. Who was going to get the town? Well, we figured that the railroad planted 1,000 acres of not only apple trees, but all those rocks were cleared were probably wheat. So you had bands of wheat and bands of orchard, so that when you came up in the valley, which is when you're coming up, you see it, that, oh, let's go that way, because that's where prosperity is. That's where good ground is. And so people, it actually turned people towards Kalispell. Did it work? You betcha. Marion picked up every one of their houses and moved to Kalispell. And the town is no longer there. So this was probably a propaganda more than anything else. It was probably also, by the apples we're finding, hard cider. It was probably a big hard cider operation. This is Jody Milton's ranch. This is in Joliet. This is another one I found. Jody Milton, she loves this orchard. And if anybody's pruned an old orchard tree, it takes literally hours. When she found this orchard, or when they acquired this orchard, when they bought the property, she took it upon herself. She took almost 6 years to prune every one of these trees herself, which is amazing. And when you look at it, it's kind of amazing, really, how many old trees are on the side of this hill in Joliet, Montana, of all places. She has apples that I don't have a clue what they are. There was one. She has five apple trees. She calls it her baking apple. It is the ugliest apple I've ever seen. It's flesh colored. It's kind of tan with these pinky stripes on it, and it's an awful looking apple. I would not even think of it to be an apple from far away. I would say, what is that? But it's an apple. And I was like, oh, it's a baking apple. And I didn't really realize why she called it a baking apple. And I took a bite, and whoa, that is the worst tasting apple I have ever had. And she was like, I know, but when you bake it, it makes a great apple. And I was like, come on, can't be. So I was like, I've never seen an apple like this before. So what do? I bring a bunch of apples down. I bring it to Jerry Cashman. Jerry Cashman knows a lot about apples. Take it to Jerry and say, Jerry, what kind of apple is? Never seen an apple like that before. Never seen anything like it before. I said, well, Jerry, take a bite of that apple. Tell me what you think. Took a bite, spit it out. Amazing. I've never seen Jerry Cashman spit out an apple. He loves apples that much. He's like, what is wrong with that apple? And then I had pressed it into cider. I said, well, taste the cider and tell me what you think. That's really good cider. It came from those apples. Isn't that bizarre? So here's one of those situations where it may not be a marketable fresh apple, but it might make a great cider apple, or who knows. But we find cool things like that. By the way, this the history of this, not from Jody or her parents, but from the people before, their family acquired it from their great-grandfather who won it in a poker game. That's what they say. I don't know if that's true. But it's still really cool. Okay, really quickly, because I'm running out of time. How does a landowner benefit from this? Well, they get the sign, okay? So it's kind of agritourism. They get to be on the website, which I'll show you here in a bit. They get assistance in pruning from us. And then they kind of, you know, the agritourism and then the potential revenue. Because if we find a really cool old apple or one that's disease resistant, or you know, one that might make a great cider, and we propagate this, and it blows up, as I say. In other words, it really starts to get really, people get really excited about this apple, to where we're producing now, instead of 100 apples, 10,000 of these to sell to different areas, and maybe even find that old cultivar that might be a great one for an orchard. Then all of a sudden, instead of maybe a $1 billion apple, but it's definitely worth, it could possibly be worth hundreds of thousands of dollars if we find the right apple. So when you look at royalties, that's a good thing for them. Is it something that we're going to find? Who knows? It's the verdict's still out. We're still doing a lot of research on this. We still don't quite understand all of the genetic things that we're finding out there. But I would say in 5 to 10 years, we will know what we can find out there as far as resistance, a Deucen apple, an old cultivar, a lost cultivar. I have to say that there's a gentleman in Minnesota that's doing this that found three lost cultivars. In other words, Cornell, who has the Apple Museum, doesn't have this in their DNA registry. So that means that they were old cultivars that we have lost that we have now brought back, which is super cool. So we're going to be able to sell these at local orchards. And I got to tell you, we're right in the right time, because everywhere you go, anybody that's selling heritage apples, heritage apple trees, are sold out so fast. We're having a tough time just even in our traditional orchards trying to find enough trees to grow an orchard, because they're all taken. We have to order trees in usually July for the following year, or we're not going to get trees. They're just not going to be out there. So it's a very exciting time. If you want to know more about the program, go to mtorchards.org. That's our website. You can contact myself or Brent Sarche. And one of the things I want to show you, if you go there, and I know I'm running out of time, so I probably won't play around with this, but I hope you do go home and take a look at mtorchards.org. You have an interactive map, and it's really not. I got to laugh, because we have about 70 heritage orchards in the program now. What we have up here is probably about 25. We're still trying to get them uploaded into the map. But we have everything from Willard, Montana. Anybody know where Willard, Montana is? Well, you're almost in North Dakota, about halfway through the state by Weibo, all through the state. So you can click on any one of these little icons, and it'll tell you about the different types of orchards, how many trees are there. Eventually, it'll tell you what kinds of cultivars are there. Maybe get some pictures. You can also go to another link down here, and you can find where our research orchards are. You can find out more about the program, and if you know about an old orchard, you can come up here and click on this button and register your orchard. That way we put the information, we can contact you. I just saw one in Modlow area, and I saw one down Dry Creek. There's some right around here. Oh, and another one up Sourdough. So I'm finding more and more orchards just locally, and that was within the last 2 weeks. So we're finding a lot more orchards. So if you know of one out there that's not on the list, let me know. With that, I will take any questions. Questions? Yes.
We've all heard the story of Johnny Appleseed.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes he planted, but he was actually taking a certain type of crab apple and taking the seeds from that and putting it out, because the crab apples do somewhat remain genetically kind of the same. But really, it wasn't about the eating apple. It was about the just producing any kind of apple to produce a sugar to make hard cider. That's really what this whole thing kind of came down to. We've always been told that he was, you know, out there planting the trees so that everybody would have something to eat. That is pretty much hogwash. He would, when we were settling this country, he would figure out where the next river was, and he would start planting apples and getting his orchard set up before people would move to that spot. And then he was the guy to find if you wanted to have alcohol, because you didn't have alcohol unless you knew Johnny Appleseed. It's kind of interesting. Michael Pollan, I credit him in one of his books to find a lot of that information. Yeah, up here. Can the seeds? I don't know if the seeds could, but it wouldn't matter, because it's not the genetics that would be what we're looking for, because it's cross-pollinated, and so it's not true to type. So a Macintosh seed is not going to produce a Macintosh. So it would be worthless to try to save the seed. So the way we would keep those is to have seedlings or scion wood, which doesn't keep very long. That would be pretty tough to do. Yeah, you'd probably know better than I would, wouldn't you, Tom? Okay, there you go. Yeah. Tom is a geneticist, so I rely on him a lot when we have questions like that. Any other questions? Yeah.
You mentioned wealthy apples a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I don't seem to find those in the supermarket.
No, you don't. Why don't you find a lot of these apples? When was the last time you went to a supermarket and found Wolf River? Or maybe even Macintosh, Northwest Greening? Why is that? They come out of Washington, yeah. But here's the problem. When you look at a grocery store, a lot of folks don't understand this. But when you go and buy an apple at the grocery store, how old do you think that apple is? It's had its first birthday. The average apple in a grocery store is over 13 months old. Because we have figured out that if we put these apples in big crates and we store them in a big building, when they drop the temperature down to 28 degrees and we pump out the ethylene and we pump in the CO2, we can store apples for 3, 4, 5 years. If I say Red Delicious to you, what do you say? Yeah, I always hear that. Terrible apple. Why do you think they called it Red Delicious? It was a great apple on the tree. But the problem is, 13 months, they get tough skin, they turn mealy. They don't do well, so that's why it went out of flavor. The longest running apple ever was the Red Delicious, but because it won't go with our storing, that's why all the apples that you buy now have to go through the storing of those apples that goes for over 13 months. If not, they're not going to make it. This is one of the reasons why we're promoting this, because we would like to see some of these apples back in farmers markets. When you go to farmers markets, how many times do you see apples? You just don't. We would like to see apples in markets again, and some local foods. I think that, you know, we have You're never going to see a yellow transparent. By the time you ship it to the farmer's market, it's already going to be rotten. But you're going to find some of these other cultivars. And some of these trees have some pretty good storing capacities. Maybe not some of these really old ones. Harlson, how many of you have heard of Harlson? They'll store forever. They don't taste that great. People think they taste great, but even Harlson himself in 1920 said it would store in a house full of five teenage boys. Which meant they weren't that good. They're hard, horrible apples. They need a freeze before you even taste good. So people would pick a Merlot, put them in the house, and they were kind of, all right, I guess, you know, it's February. I guess I'll eat one of those horrible apples. But we do have some pretty decent apples out there. I tasted one the other day. What am I saying? It was today. I was at Arrow Peak. He was like, taste this apple. This one came out of the one that Brent forgot to ID. And I tasted it. I was like, wow. Like, that is something I've never tasted before. It had the qualities to be a really good cider apple and maybe even a hard cider apple because it had this kind of, like, sprightliness. You know, if you ever buy a can of Sprite, did you know that came from apples? Because the word sprightliness was a word that was naming apples. It was that when you bite into it, it's whoo, that kind of ha, you know, that effervescent. That came, I believe, from apples. I think that's where that came, because you hear about the sprightliness, the sprite of an apple. You read about that, which is kind of cool. Yeah?
The pioneers that came here bringing their apple trees from the East Coast or from Europe?
East Coast mainly, but we don't know. We think that maybe some people brought trees from Europe, some trees that we don't even know. Who knows what's out there? So that's what's exciting about it, is we may be able to find some of these old cultivars that we didn't even think were here or could be here. And if they've lived for over 100 years in Montana with all of our conditions, then we might find some cool apples. Like I said, I was just up at that nursery or the orchard where they're growing strictly hard cider apples. And that guy is excited about all of these weirdo apples we're finding, because weirdo apples means really awesome hard cider to him. Right? So, because most hard cider is made from, you know, not so great of apple. And that's what makes hard cider, different hard ciders good. Yeah?
How long has Pine Black been around?
Oh, gosh.
Do you think it was back in the golden age?
I don't know. I couldn't tell you how long it's been around. I'm not a plant pathologist. That's one of the weird things about being a horticulturist is I know enough to be dangerous about a lot of different things. I don't know the answer to that. I don't know how long it's been around. It's been around for a long time, and it's sporadic. The Gallatin Valley's hammered with it. Other parts of the state, when we go, even some of these old orchards, might be because they're isolated from other apple trees. We don't find fire blight in some of these old orchards. But I don't know the answer to that question. If you want to contact me, I will find the answer to that if I can. Yeah. So yeah, hopefully you learn a little bit about what we do, some of the exciting research that we're doing, some of the exciting things that might be happening from these trees, whether or not it's disease resistance, old stories. I mean, how cool is it that you might be able to go to the nursery and look at a tree and be like, whoa, look at it, it's got a little tag that tells a story of where this tree came from. You know, where did we find this? And like I said, we're just starting right now. In fact, we have right now 500 trees at the propagator in four different cultivars. And four of the cultivars, we don't even know what the cultivar is. We just know it's an awesome apple. And we're going to propagate it. And we're going to figure out what this apple is. So we're kind of trying to get ahead of the curve because we don't even know. We just know that it's one of those unique apples that's not in any other orchard that you may actually see in a nursery at some point in time. Oh, that's a really good question. What other states? Really, the pioneers of this was New Mexico. New Mexico was doing this with citrus and nuts. Minnesota, there's a gentleman in Minnesota. Wyoming is doing this. I believe Utah is doing this. This is really kind of a popular thing now because for decades, people have been trying to figure out what these apples are just by looking and tasting. But now, because we can look at the DNA, it's clicking with people like, now we can figure out what these are. And that's really fun. It is kind of disheartening for people. I have one orchard where she swears she has a northern spy apple. She doesn't have a northern spy apple. And I had to go to her and say, that's not a northern spy. But she's been labeling it a northern spy forever. And she goes, well, I'm just going to keep calling it that. I was like, you can call it whatever you want, but it's not a northern spy. It might, and I can't remember, it might be a prairie spy or something like that, but I don't even think it was a prairie spy. It was something completely different, but yeah, it's kind of interesting. But, yeah. Yes. Yeah, because you cut it and you put it in water, and so it's a clone. The only problem is if you take the cutting of those trees, usually they're not hardy because the rootstock, weirdly enough, determines the hardiness of the tree. So then that what you're cutting might produce a tree, but it may not make it through our winter. So it's our rootstock that it's kind of weird. There's a whole bunch that goes on with apples. So it's the rootstock that determines a lot of times the hardiness of the apple. Yeah. All right, one last question because I know I got to go. Oh, that's dependent of the tree. So once you graft a tree, we usually don't sell a tree until it's a two-year-old tree here in Montana. A lot of times it's a one-year-old tree in other places, but two-year-old tree. And then it's dependent on the species or the cultivar of that apple of how long it's going to take before it starts producing. Carol is an apple that will produce literally the second year that you plant it, maybe first or even second year. Sweet 16, you might as well wait 8 years. You're never going to get an apple on that tree. It's going to take forever for it to start to produce. So it just depends on the apple cultivar. So, all right, well, I'll answer questions if anybody has any individual questions. And thank you so much for coming out tonight.